This hour's subject should, I hope, make more space than there was this morning for open discussion. It's a different kind of question, and it doesn't require the same kind of survey of factual historical background that we needed in the preceding hour. I suppose most of you were here, but it would be appropriate just to review what ground we covered. The just war tradition is the majority position among Christian thinkers since the 4th century about the morality of war. It says that war is evil, but sometimes it may be an unavoidable and therefore justified evil. But those sometimes need to be tested by the application of criteria such as the legitimacy of the authority that wages the war, the cause that is waged for, the means that are used, etc. We distinguish that from three other ways of reasoning. Pacifism, which says no in general. A blank check kind of approach, which is sometimes called realistic, which says that it is not either not possible or not desirable for the individual, at least, maybe a prince, but not for anybody else, the believer in general, to exercise any moral responsibility because you do what the nation calls for. And fourthly, the crusade, in which war is a righteous or even a holy cause. Those are the four basic kinds of logic. The just war way of thinking, or the justifiable war way of thinking, is distinguished from the others in its application of a considerable number of criterion questions, whereby one hopes to come to a conclusion that this war may be justified, this one may not. Now, to look over the history, one comes to the conclusion that although this has been the dominant theory among thinkers, there's serious doubt about whether it has been the practice. That is, whether church leadership, people in general, government people in general, actually made decisions on the basis of these criteria. Some critics of the tradition ask, has there ever been a just war that would meet all of those requirements? Other critics ask, did the doctrine ever work in the past so as to say no? That is, was there ever a time when a given war would have been selfishly attractive, but a government or a person in government or king would have said, we won't do it because it would be morally wrong? I'd like to commend for your study one of the books in the bookstore. Peace Ways is the title. It's a collection of brief contributions from many people, edited by Charles Lutz and Jerry Folk. And the particular article that I want to point to is written by one of the editors, by Charles Lutz, who is in the Social Concern Office of the Minnesota Lutheran headquarters. Already 10 years ago, he was one of the people providing leadership in making it possible for selective objectors to think through their position and receive some kind of moral support from the Lutheran churches. His article is entitled "The Search for a Just Security Ethic." He's saying that just as you have to ask questions about a war, so you must also ask the same kind of moral questions about armament, about getting ready, about what claims to be security. He lists 7 criteria, which are pretty much like the ones that I listed from the tradition. And then he notices specific criticisms of the theory. It has seldom worked in practice to prevent a war. We don't know, of course, about the wars that might have been that didn't happen. But at least it would be interesting if we ever had such a report. But leaders of nations are not in the habit of announcing to the world, we have assessed the situation and decided that the war we are contemplating is not justifiable. Secondly, the theory, developed to justify exceptions to the ethic of the gospel, became an excuse justifying any war. That is, if you take it straight, it calls for discrimination. What really happens, once it gets in the creeds, of course, is that everybody thinks, well, that means that war is all right, which the doctrine never meant, but it comes to mean that. Thirdly, the theory assumes complete knowledge of facts. Because in order to know what's at stake, what the cause really is, who really committed the first offense, what are the chances of winning, you would have to have all the facts, and yet no nations encourage full public disclosure. Nobody has all the facts. Fourthly, the theory is at best useful in a limited war situation, as the kind of wars that were fought up until a century ago, pre-total wars. Total war and guerrilla war have no place under the theory. And he concludes, my opinion is that all of the four criticisms are valid. And there would be more. But now I'm just asking about the history. Has the doctrine been respected? Has it been respected by people only going to war when the war that they were interested in going to met the requirements and otherwise saying no? I think the general record is clear. The doctrine has not been consciously implemented in decision-making by responsible people, governments, citizens in recent years, now that we have democratic structures. Very seldom even afterwards in evaluation, when one could have said, well, we thought it was justified, but it wasn't. Very seldom does one find that being said. What was really going on then was wars in the other two categories, that is, holy wars, where people really believed that the adversary had no rights, the adversary weren't people like us, or God was on our side, and anything we did was all right because of the justice of our cause, ideological crusades or religious crusades, or what was going on was simply national self-interest, most of the time. The theologians never said that national self-interest is a valid reason, but the members of their churches went off and fought those wars. The theologians seldom said since the 17th century that it can be a divine cause, but many of the local preachers and chaplains and non-theological people thinking religious thoughts did believe that their wars were crusades. So that seems to be the lesson of history, that what really happened was not according to the just war theory, but the theologians who wanted to be morally responsible said that that's all that would be justified. Just war language has been used as a language for criticism by people who disapproved of a war in a minority situation. I mentioned this morning, especially the modern Vietnam experience, it may be that people were thinking that way much longer without using those words exactly, even way back in the time of the American Revolution, when, as one of the group reminded me, many people, probably the majority, thought it wasn't a justified revolution, but they didn't happen to be the ones running the colonial government. In the War of 1812, there were preachers in New England who said it was not a just war. In the war against Mexico, Abraham Lincoln said it wasn't a just war. So the just war language was available as a way of expressing a negative criticism by a minority, but that still falls one step short of application. But now the question for this evening is, for people who don't want to be in any of the other three categories, and who either because it's morally sensible and intelligent, or because it's what stands in the tradition, the confessions, for people who want to live up to the moral discipline of the just war tradition, what will it take for that to be credible or to be honest? Now, why am I interested in the credibility of that position, if it's not my own position? Well, there are several good reasons, I think. One is that it's always educationally valuable to keep trying to converse with other positions than your own, and I need to do that in my teaching connections in two different institutions. In fact, one could say that you only have the right to hold your own position if you have a full understanding of the other options. And if you're not fully cognizant of what the other positions are, then maybe your own position isn't credible either. There's more than that, though. There's an ecumenical affirmation. As any kind of Christian believer, I ought to be committed. But especially as a Christian believer holding a minority position, one has to be committed to ongoing conversation with the majority positions and the other traditions. So that's just in principle something one ought to do on any question, including this one. But more important than this, I'm interested in the moral integrity of people who say they hold to the just war tradition. That is, they say that what they are ready to do at the behest of their government is not murder. They're not willing to do anything. They're not willing to kill the innocent. They are not willing to fight for unjust causes. They haven't given government a blank check. They are morally responsible. They will only fight if it is really a case of the least possible evil, last resort, according to all the rules and the criteria. Well, if my fellow believers think that, I have a stake in their integrity, in their living up to that statement of themselves. So that's really the main reason. My commitment to the integrity of people who say they hold that position makes me want to help them hold that position with honesty, if they can, and if it's really what they believe. There is a further strong reason, though, and that is that if the people who say they hold to the just war theory actually act that way, it will be much better for the victims of the war that they won't fight. That is, the restraint that they exercise will save somebody's life. And at that point, the pacifist and the just war person are together in not wanting to take the life of someone in an unjust war. So that's enough by way of reason for my investing years, because I've been working in this area at the University of Notre Dame, which has the largest ROTC contingent in the country, for some time. There's one more reason way down the line. You might think that you hold to the just war theory, and you might try to apply it honestly, and you might discover that in the effort to do so, it falls apart in your hands. It isn't usable. It isn't reasonable. It doesn't fit the facts. Then you might have a further reason to look at the other options again and to be less convinced that the just war position is the right position in basic Christian terms. But it isn't the expectation that everybody will be convinced of that makes me want to think. One other observation about the history of the way the doctrine has worked, kind of reinforcing right in the present the kind of things we studied this morning. And that is that although people who hold to the just war position always say there is a limit, these things we must do, but not that. Or they say we are ready to do this as long as that is not included. There's always a talk of limits. And yet as the study goes on, and as time goes on, the hurdle keeps getting lower. That is, there are more and more exceptions. I have a list of 7 that came out of recent literature that we had occasion to work with the last time we went through the subject in Notre Dame. For one thing, one will come to say that certain people are beyond the pale. That is, they don't benefit from the protection of the just war theory. If other people fight fair, then we will too. But if they don't fight fair, then they lose the right to have me fight fair with them. One example, going way back, was in the American Civil War. The Confederate strategists or soldiers had developed a new tactic, that of the landmine, that is, putting bombs in the roads where the Northern forces were going to be walking. That was a new idea. And of course, it would kill the first people that would come down the road. General Sherman, who was on other levels winning the war, considered that to be unfair. He said, that's not war, that's murder. And because of that, it was justified to make reprisals. So what he did was to take Confederate prisoners and make them march in front of the Union Army down the road so that they would be killed. Now that's counter to all the rules for the treatment of prisoners, but they had forfeited their right to be treated decently by the fact that they were using unjust methods. There were other ways in the much older history. In the Middle Ages, very often it was said that it is wrong to use a particular method or a particular weapon, since the crossbow was forbidden in 1139, I think, against Christians. But you could use it against Muslims because they aren't the same kind of people. So there are people who have the right to be treated as people, and there are people who don't have the right to be treated as people. And that continues up to the present. It was clear in the psychology of Vietnam, at least to many observers, that the freedom with which American forces were willing to jeopardize the safety of ordinary Vietnamese population would have been very different if they had been of Scandinavian extraction, if they had been our kind of people, as over against being small, of a different race, of a different culture, village culture, not knowing our language, etc. That is, it's very often the case that war categorizes certain kinds of people as not entitled to benefit from the limitations on just means. A second kind of exception that is made is that generally we like to keep the rules, and generally we should and will, but this is an emergency. This is a supreme emergency. The best book on the subject of just and unjust wars in the last 10 years is a survey written by a Harvard political science professor, Michael Walzer, who says that about the case for the bombing of cities in the Second World War. He says that really the way cities were bombed on both sides was wrong. But it would have been justified if it had been true, as the British thought, that Hitler was just about to invade England, and the invasion of England would have been the end of Western civilization. That would have been such a supreme emergency that to prevent that, it would be justified to break the rules of war. Well, that supreme emergency for Walzer is something farther down the road than necessity, which in many people's thought is a reason to break any rule. Now, there's an ambivalence in the texts. Francis Lieber, of whom I spoke this morning, said that the concept of necessity simply means you must never do anything you don't have to, but it's never a justification for breaking the rules of war. It's only that you do as much as you have to up to the limits of the rules of war, but not more than that. That's also what is said in the field manual, which is currently officially in effect in the American Army. But more often, necessity means a reason for exceptions breaking the rule. That ordinarily we won't kill prisoners, but if we have to, because we have to move on fast and the safety of our operation depends on it, then we can kill prisoners. Most often the word necessity means that, and it means that anything is less binding than it looked in the rules. But there's another kind of concept that is very current. We need to lower the requirements so that the rules can be kept. That is, if the rules ask something impossible, unreasonable, well, then they won't be kept. So we have to ask less so that people don't disregard all law. A good specimen of this was the submarine story in the First World War. The rules for submarine engagement had been derived from the rules for surface naval engagement. You don't have a right to shoot at another ship until you have determined that it has weapons on it. Well, if two similar ships encountered each other in the high seas, they could find that out and it would there'd still be time for a fight. But if a submarine has to surface first and then finds out by surprise that that is not a merchant marine ship hauling foodstuffs, but it is an armed British vessel, it's too late. So the Germans first tried to respect that rule in the First World War when they had more submarines, and they were losing the submarine war. So they stopped respecting the rule and started shooting before surfacing, because they had learned that most of the time the British ships, even if they look like a merchant ship, are armed. That meant that one more of the rules isn't observed. Those rules were restated in the 20s, but they were never respected. And in the Second World War, they were again not respected at all. But at the Nuremberg trials, American naval officers testified in favor of German naval officers, saying that those rules were dead letter. We can't ask the German Navy to keep them because we didn't keep them. So you have to lower the requirements of the rules in order not to have them be a laughingstock and pointless. Same kind of thing applies to national liberation forces. It used to be that the rules for who has the right to be dealt with as a soldier, so that if he's captured, he's a prisoner of war, is that they had to have a uniform. But you can't fight a guerrilla war with people in uniform. So that requirement had to be redefined. So you lower the requirements in order not to have impossible requirements. Another kind of argument is that if you're too firm about the requirements of the rules, you'll make yourself irrelevant politically. That is, people just won't take you seriously. That is said once in the current draft LCA statement on peace and politics. It says if you call for unilateral disarmament, you just won't be taken seriously in political debate. And then there's one more statement, which I think I mentioned this morning. Whether these rules are meant to be kept in the first place or not. Certainly they were, historically. And I'll spell that out in a minute. But increasingly there are people who say, no, you can't ever meet them. It's just a matter of knowing about them so that you come as close as you can, or so that you have a language for common discourse, so that if you're debating about something, you can ask the question of just authority, ask the question of means and respecting the treaties, etc. But that it's unreasonable to think that the requirements would ever have to be met. And that means, of course, it would be unreasonable to think you'd ever say no because they haven't been met. Well, in the past, people were ready to say that the just war tradition does have to mean willingness to say no to a particular war if it doesn't meet the requirements. And that means, if you're serious, willingness not to win the war, if that's what it would take. That is, willingness to lose. Paul Ramsey is the Protestant in our generation who has done the most to revitalize discussion about the just war tradition. He said that very clearly in a book in 1961. The equivalent most qualified Roman Catholic thinker in the same period, no longer living, John Courtney Murray, said the same thing in that same period. A World Council of Churches study group in 1957 said the same thing. You aren't honest with the just war position in its traditional meaning if there is not a point at which you are willing to lose rather than to use unjust means or fight for an unjust cause. And in its basic logic, that was even what Martin Luther said way back when he made that hypothetical statement to the effect that if you know your prince is fighting an unjust war, you should refuse to help. So traditionally, the doctrine clearly did mean that. It meant saying there are some things which are so clearly counter to the criteria of the just war way of thinking that we would rather lose the war than do those things. Now the question is, if that's what the doctrine means, honestly, what will it take to be honest? Well, the first thing that it will take will be to say that. To say that the nation is not an absolute value, or that the values a nation stands for, although important, are not absolute values. To say that clearly enough that there is a basis then for working together to act upon that. Again, to look at the LCA document, it begins with a general statement about the wrongness of idolatry, that no human value is absolute, but then it slides very rapidly into the idea that the defense of our nation is, practically speaking, an absolute, because there is no point beyond which we wouldn't be ready to go to defend it if we had to. The Roman Catholic Bishop's pastoral letter of last May does not specifically say what you do if a weapon is unjustifiable or if a war can't be won without using unjustifiable weapons. It talks much more clearly than people had before about the weapons being unjustifiable. But what you do, well, in peacetime you work against having those weapons as a citizen or maybe even as a soldier. But what if the war starts? And the bishops don't speak to that, whether you therefore have to become a selective conscientious objector or whether you go along with the war after all because you haven't been able to stop it. They don't say. To say no would not be in principle unpatriotic. It would be to define patriotism in terms of the values the nation is supposed to stand for. When Abraham Lincoln was against the American participation in the war against Mexico in the 1840s, it wasn't because he was unpatriotic. It was because that war was unworthy of the vision that the American people had of their character, for them to be carrying on an aggressive war of imperialism against a weak neighbor. This readiness to say that if the only way to win a war is to do it unjustly, we don't want to win, is an intellectual statement, but of course it's much more than that. It's a psychic reorganization. It's a fundamentally different mentality. that is not at all taken for granted just because people say that there's only one God and that they don't want to make an idol of the nation. Now, what will be the intellectual content of this integrity once one has said in principle that one is willing to have a line? Well, the criteria would have to be stated. I said they're common sense criteria, and they are, that is, they just rise out of our common awareness when we think about it. But it is striking that in the almost 1700 years since this has become the dominant Christian position, there has never been one official normative list of those criteria. The documents that the Lutheran Church used in the early 70s to guide COs, selective COs, had the same list of seven criteria that Charles Lutz has in this article. He wrote some of those other materials too, and if you'd ask John Schramm, he would tick off those same 7 points because those were the ones that were used in Lutheran literature. But there are other lists that have more and other lists that have fewer. The LCA document that I just mentioned has others. So it's funny. When it's supposed to be the normative majority Christian position for 1,500 years, and we don't even have the same statement of what it's about. Never a standard statement. Another part of needing to be intellectually qualified, having your ideas straight, has to do with the way the different criteria interlock and what each criterion by itself means. You can only have a war if it's fought by a just authority. In the Middle Ages, that meant your prince had to be the son of a prince. He had to be legitimately your government. But what does it mean when you have the idea of democracy, which means that a government is subject to review every few years, or even the idea of revolution, which means that there are governments which exist firmly and are legitimate in terms of succession, but which ought to be upset or destroyed because they aren't good enough? What does that do to the notion of the authority to wage a war? Who has a right to revolt? Another one of the criteria in the old days was that you must never do anything that is intrinsically sinful, apart from the killing itself, because it isn't intrinsically sinful if you have to do it. But you must not commit any other sins. In the Middle Ages, Thomas Aquinas was utterly serious in saying that you must not tell a lie, even to win a war, because lying is a sin. And obviously, you must not steal. You must not commit any sin. The one thing that you do that normally is sin is killing, but that's not sin in this case. But you must not commit any other sins, because there was a notion of absolute moral integrity at certain other points. You may deceive your enemy by not telling him the whole truth, but you must not tell your enemy an untruth. You may lie in ambush, but you may not lie. And that was serious. Now, point is not to make fun of the Middle Ages. It is to be aware that Christians who made room for war meant they didn't mean to be letting down all the bars on morality in general, and everything to you do what you have to in order to keep on top of the world. Now, what is that? What comes of that notion that you don't infringe on any other moral obligations but that of not killing? And another kind of question is what it means when the reading comes up negative. That is, American soldiers in Vietnam at least once committed an atrocity. You know what? Because Lieutenant Cali, who was lieutenant, there was also a captain, right, was found guilty. So we know it was done. Does that atrocity make the war unjust? Well, apparently one doesn't, but how about five? Or how about 50? When would a war become unjust because it wasn't fought according to the rules? When the agreement to end the war was almost signed, and it had been widely said publicly that it was almost signed, there were a few details where the Hanoi representatives were still haggling and wanting something more. And the United States, in Christmas of 1972, unleashed over Hanoi the most massive bombing of the war, with no regard for civilian immunity, and no proportion to the stakes in the war. Did that make the war wrong? Did that change anything? After the war was in the process of being forgotten, a man who was being interviewed for a position in the CIA, Mr. Colby, said right in the open in public interviews that he had been in charge of something called Operation Phoenix, which had killed 20,000 people without any process of law just because somebody didn't like them. What does that do to the rightness of our being in Vietnam? The rules ought to say that, wouldn't they have to, if they're going to work? And yet there isn't any common understanding of the point at which you lose your right to go on with the war because you're not fighting according to the rules. So that would have to be thought through. That would have to be defined in a way that people could respect. Respect in both senses. That is, the people who want to live according to that could do it, and other people who ask whether it is an honest position could have respect for it. A next question, and this is a very practical institutional one, it's the educational component of integrity. If you claim that you are thinking on the basis of this tradition, well, then you will teach it to your children, or you'll want to learn it yourselves. It'll be in catechesis for anybody who's going to be a citizen, or anybody who's going to be in a position of authority, or anybody who's going to be in the military. It would be a normal thing to study or to teach to the youth. How many of you learned about the just war principles when you went through Lutheran catechesis? How many of you heard them? Is there one hand? How many of you heard these criteria talked about in a context of Christian education or Christian moral thinking, even in the high days of Vietnam? Last time I talked about this, there were about 3 people that said yes, and 1 foot from upstairs. So it's there, but it's just barely there. Whereas if we really believed it, or if you really believed it, it would be part of the regular educational accountability of every parish in every Christian school to teach everyone who's going to be a citizen or potentially going to be a draftee or potentially going to have any share in public decision-making what the limits are of justifiable war. And that would be taught in such a way that it wouldn't just be a matter of one lonely 18-year-old trying to figure out if he's going to go to Vietnam now, sometime in 1961, but it could be a common discussion of Christians together, or in a democracy of citizens together, because after all, the criteria are quite objective. They aren't matters of whim or intuition, they're matters of fact out there. And matters of fact, that brings me to my next point of what would be the institutional prerequisites of taking the doctrine seriously. Whether a war is just, according to the tradition, depends on facts. And in that sense, the just war tradition is different from the other three. To be a crusader, I just have to be told by the Pope that it's a holy cause. And I don't check what right the Arabs have to have the Holy Land or who my king is. I just go because the Pope tells me. And it's always that way with a crusade. And it's always that way with the blank check or the realistic position. You just do what your government says. The details of the historical situation aren't important. And even there's a sense in which for the pacifists they aren't important. Because whatever the issue, killing is not the way to go about serving even a justifiable cause for the pacifist. But for the just war position, it's utterly different. It depends on a lot of facts. Who owns that land? If it was taken, was it taken malevolently, or do the people who take it think they have a right to it? What means have been tried to resolve it peaceably? Are we really in a situation of last resort? Can we win this war? That's certainly based on an awful lot of facts of economics and training and organization and lay of the land. So whether a potential act of hostility meets the just war criteria depends on empirical facts out there. That is, things you have to go out and find out. Look them up. Well, the governments are not going to give you the facts. That was already said briefly in the Charles Lutz quote. The governments are not interested in giving you a basis for a factual verification and double-checking of whether the cause for war is what they say it is. So that means you have to have your own source of facts. There would have to be a service for Christians and other morally concerned persons to check out the facts which lie behind the claim of government to have a just war. That wouldn't be impossible. It would be a research kind of agency, a journalistic kind of agency, an information source. If you claim that you're going to make decisions about the justification of war on the basis of the facts, you'll have to claim that you got the facts. And you can't believe government propaganda for that purpose, which it would be a contradiction in terms. One more kind of thing that would also be called for to take the doctrine seriously, and that is alternatives. If you can't defend a certain cause morally by war, that doesn't mean you just give up and go limp and lose it. The normal thing that it would mean would be that you find ways to defend it without war, non-militarily. Since Stephen King Hall, the British naval officer whom I referred to last week, started saying it in 1945, said it in book length in the late 50s, there has been some, but only very little, serious attention to alternative means of defense against the evil that some enemy nation might want to do to you. That is, if you can't feasibly defend what you want to defend anymore by the modern weapons, because they'll blow up in your face or they'll destroy everything, how can you then defend that? There's a growing, although still modest, body of social science, scenario writing, and the study of other levels of social conflict in the past, and nonviolent national defense, a slim number of anecdotes being studied and analyzed. If non-pacifist just war thinkers were serious, they would be studying these alternatives. As a matter of fact, it's mostly pacifists that study them. They would be studying these alternatives because they would be part of the weighing of when you're in a situation of last resort, and they would be a part of your saying you're committed to save these values, that is, the freedoms that you're sure you would lose if you lost the war, or the other elements of national interest that you're sure you would lose if you lost the war. With regard to the weapons we have, with regard to the potential enemies we have, whether it be Libya or Iran or anyone else, our Pentagon is all the time working out contingency plans and scenarios for wars that are never going to happen. We don't invest anything comparable in thinking about how we would go about defending whatever it is we want to defend if we were in a situation where it couldn't possibly be defended militarily, or where it couldn't morally be defended militarily. And anyone who claims that they haven't sold out to unthinking obedience needs to think about those alternatives, so that you aren't in the situation of last resort where the only thing you can do is military. Very often, one hears currently with regard to South Africa or Central America, the people who are committed to the moral necessity of radical social change saying nonviolent means have been tried and they didn't work, so now the only thing is violence. That isn't a fair test unless the investment in nonviolent means was the same as in the violent means. Same number of people willing to shed their own blood, same number of dollars, same amount of money for planning, same number of war colleges to prepare people with the skills that it takes, the same readiness to discipline and to make sacrifices, then it would be a fair comparison. Of course, it never has been. And all of the places where violence was tried and hasn't produced results, people don't count that as proving that violence doesn't work. They just think they need more of it in order to win better than the last failure. So thinking about alternatives is also a part of the credibility of people's claiming that there are limits to the justification of the violence they're willing to resort to. Now, which of those marks of seriousness you want to pursue, is up to you. My concern is simply that we take with utmost seriousness the logic of the just war tradition. It says, to repeat, but to capsule, some things one must never do, even for the sake of a valid cause. Is that true? If it isn't true, then the just war position isn't there after all, and people are really living the anything-goes position or the crusade position. If there is that limit, then it'll take the kinds of things I've talked about to make it real and accountable in the lives of non-pacifist Christians or a non-pacifist society. Now we have plenty of time to talk.
You mentioned alternatives. An example, would that be like economic sanctions and political infiltration, or what kind of things you're talking about as alternatives to a kind of solution of war?
Well, what would count as an alternative would count on what the evil is that you're trying to stop. Already since the period between the wars, to stop certain offenses, certain kinds of economic sanctions were thought of as reasonable. And there's no indication they wouldn't have worked if they'd been applied. They weren't applied because the League of Nations that started to do that fell apart on other grounds and didn't have internal discipline. But sometimes economic sanctions can work on a nation-to-nation scale, or with, especially if all the nations get together. That would be one line, but that would be a little like the United Nations military force. It'll only work if the problem isn't big enough to break down the international system. And in a major war, the international system does break down. The kind of thing that King Hall was talking about, and that numerous of the other people thinking about civilian-based defense, including the passage from Ron Sider's book that I pointed to last week. Well, maybe I should look at that, name that, because some of you weren't here. Ronald Sider and Richard Taylor are the co-authors of a book called Nuclear Holocaust and Christian Hope, which is in the bookstore, and which has three chapters on how one might defend America nonviolently. And there it means defense against invasion. What did the Dutch, the Danes, the Norwegians, the French do to defend themselves when they were occupied? What can be learned from that? There have been histories of being occupied and defending one's values. What would it mean if we invested in that, if we got ready for it, if we trained for it? And then it would look more like Gandhi and King than it would like international economic sanctions. That is, what would it take to defend the values of this continent against Soviet occupation that the Soviets wanted to occupy us? Now, there's a lot of people doubt that the Soviets would want to occupy us. They have enough trouble with the people they're occupying already. They can't run Poland, they can't run Afghanistan. What would they do with North America? But assuming they could and wanted to, and that they weren't demoralized at the first McDonald's, and by the general affluence of the place, there are spiritual ways to resist tyranny. And you can certainly do it a lot better if you thought about it ahead of time than if you didn't think about it ahead of time. And we could invest in thinking about it ahead of time instead of using all our think tanks on bigger and better bombs.
Yeah, I would just sort of underline that. I don't know if you know how to think about that, and that's the problem. Yeah, the idea of nonviolent defense, and it's like a pill. You don't know how to conceive of it.
You don't if you haven't thought about it. I mean, that's the way it is. I mean, 100 years ago, nobody thought about sitting on a metal apparatus with two wheels and not falling off. Now we know that bicycles work, because we've had enough of them that we've learned how to handle our balance. Because any shift in culture calls for new thinking, and if we haven't done the new thinking, we think it's unthinkable. And yet, just within the past 3 years, there has been an enormous moral victory of Poles over Russians in a situation where they had no power. And the Russians are still there, and the Poles still have a military government. But the morale of the place has turned around because of the victories of solidarity. They're still suffering. But they know they have dignity as Poles. And the Russians, and even the Marxist party and the Marxist doctrine within Poland, have no respectability at all anymore. because of the power of solidarity, which was a not only Christian, but largely Christian, Catholic, nonviolent movement. Well, we haven't studied that, but we could. And before that, there was the Czech resistance to the Soviet takeover in 68 and the Hungarian resistance to the Soviet takeover in 56. And each time there was a surprising moral power to slow down the reimposition of tyranny and defend national dignity and identity despite not having sovereignty. Now that's one set of cases. The people who were occupied by Hitler would be another set of cases. Other parts of the world where other kinds of clash take place would be still different. It's all hypothetical, but so is nuclear war hypothetical. What the evacuation plans they make for how to get the people, all the people from Seattle to hold them when the bomb is on the way. All of those plans are just as hypothetical as this kind of brainstorming about how one would let the Russians come but not give in to them spiritually.
What bothers me, I guess, is that I don't believe my government believes in a just war theory. And then that leaves me sitting in the pew believing in it or marching around like I did during Vietnam. But it doesn't, I don't feel very powerful about being able to believe in the just war theory when I don't believe my government uses those criteria. So where does that leave us if you live in a country that doesn't live by or subscribe to the just war theory and you subscribe to it, it leaves you kind of powerless, doesn't it?
That's a very important additional factor in the picture. I don't think our situation is as bad as that of Idi Amin or Gaddafi or Hitler, where somebody in government would actually proclaim, "I don't care about morality." Our government claims to care about legality and morality, but we don't trust it. I still think that claim can be appealed to. It can be used as a subject for public debate. We can still say it's counter to our constitution to be sending people to fight the Nicaraguans without a declaration of war, the War Powers Bill, that kind of thing. We still have handles as citizens and as public opinion and as journalists which depend upon the just war mentality. So we can use it, but it's a sobering thought, but it's also part of the picture. To take stock, if it is the case that the people governing this country don't really believe in those limits, well then what's the Christian thing to think? Does that mean that we must all be dissenters? Should we go into the underground? At least it's a statement of the problem. It's very important. If you live under a government which does not admit that it is subject to any restraints, the technical word for that in theological circles is idolatry. And since that's a little of what the film will be about in the 9 o'clock period, and that is if you don't recognize any limitation to that value there, the value of the nation, you don't subject it to justice in general, to the rights of others, that is idolatry. And if Christians recognize that America, despite all its values, makes of itself an idol in this extreme case, well then that's a profound spiritual observation.
Maybe the role of Christians might be, as we speak to legislators and people who are running for office, to ask them how they feel about the just war theory. Half of them may say they don't even know what you're talking about, but then they better go home.
That'd be one thing. Well, of course, you can also just translate it in other terms, not ask them about the theory, but ask, aren't we committing aggression? Or are we respecting the sovereignty of Nicaragua? Or are we in our escalation of the nuclear potential of Western Europe, are we giving the Russians a chance to bargain in a situation of last resort? You can operationalize the criteria without using the lingo of the theological tradition.
In our understanding of nuclear arsenals now, and the very fact that these arsenals are pointed toward major cities of major countries, one of the popular responses is, well, we cannot even have a just war theory because the means are too devastating, the innocent will be killed. There's no point in talking about just war at this point. Would you see that as a cop-out or an actual within the criteria of just war, an actual analysis.
It depends. Some people have been saying since the 1940s the just war position is obsolete because there won't be again a war that will fit its requirements. I think the more careful way to say that would be now the just war position would become relevant in that it would say no instead of yes. So that you won't have a justifiable war, but you will be respecting the theory in that non-pacifists will say no to war. And in that sense, you would still be applying the just war theory. But non-pacifists will have to say no to war because there is no war using these weapons that can meet the requirements. But that's still a just war position. To say that other wars might be all right, I can imagine wars that could be all right, past wars may have been all right, hypothetical small wars with conventional weapons might be all right, but not this war with these weapons.
So then
that's a meaningful position. Whether it can be spelled out politically and hold the line between the ones you'll accept and the ones you won't, that's a different question. But at least it's logically a meaningful position to say that.
So a sense then of a détente or a balance of nuclear weapons could fit.
Well, then you have another borderline, which is where the Bishop's letter and the Vancouver World Council statement both have a difficult razor's edge to walk on. If you may never fire these weapons, may you morally threaten to fire them? The only grounds for threatening to fire them is so that you don't have to fire them. Because both parties will be so afraid that neither party will ever do anything close to the border. That's what they call deterrence, frightening people off. There's an old-fashioned moral difficulty in that. It just doesn't feel morally right to say that you can threaten to do something that you may not morally do. There are also practical difficulties in that to make the Russians believe that we may do it, we have to have everybody up and down the chain of command believing that we may do it. We have to have every lieutenant in a silo with his key thinking that it may really happen. And only somebody at the top free to decide, well, no, we never would. Well, that's very hard to believe in a democracy or in a free society. Perhaps in a tyranny, you could have one person at the top who wouldn't do what they've been talking about for the past 20 years. So it's both psychologically and morally questionable whether you may threaten mutual destruction in order not to have it. But if you can answer those questions, then that idea of the possession now with a view to tapering off and disarming, dismantling, and cooling off, there are people who still believe that that is sustainable. And the Catholic bishops left it open in order to be freer to be firmly negative on some other questions, because they hadn't finished thinking about it together. Because their major staff person think that's a possible position. There was another hand, forget, somewhere.
I was just going to say that to me the contradiction is that the process of determining just war in the first place implies a whole different set of rules. It requires an interaction, a dialogue, and a commitment that just doesn't seem to me has been exercised. Who are the people who do participate in this have to have some credibility? From where do they gain that? And are they church leaders, political leaders?
Well, you're just adding detail to the questions I was asking in the last part. In the Middle Ages, that was possible. That is, a bishop would tell this prince and that prince, these are the rules, you keep the rules. And they could. If they didn't, they would be excommunicated until they apologized. So then there was a decision-making process, there was a structure, they knew what the world was. It was thinkable in the Middle Ages. And it just got out of hand because with democracy we have so many more people wanting to think, and with demagogy we have so many people trying to manipulate the people who think. But it is imaginable that that could be restored if we had a public mind to do it. And in a sense that happened in Vietnam. More and more people said, people who weren't predisposed that way, this is just too bad. This can't go on. and ordinary people, establishment type people did. So it's not unthinkable. That's a different question from whether it will really happen. And that's up to the integrity of the non-pacifist people to decide. Thank you.